Reel 21. So on the subject of headgear, at this stage at Winchelsea, all the NCOs would wear the so-called cheese cutter hat.
Sergeants
and above.
Sergeants, yes, right. And you knew from at a glance from the distance, you saw somebody walking with a cheese cutter hat on, he was a senior non-commissioned officer. Sergeant and above.
And when were these brought in? Was that part of Colonel Murray's?
It happened during the 1941 Folkestone riot time. It could have well been, you know, I can't be adamant about that time Colonel Murray being with us immediately after Mullerman, because I'm, it was perhaps something played trick with my memory, but I don't know. I rather think that he was. But I also think that perhaps he was responsible for the G7 hats.
And you were saying earlier that some people resented these things because they thought they were making them go bald.
Yes.
What was it? Was that the general opinion that the NCOs...
Yes, that's right. The news was that those damn hats made you lose your hair. Because you had that thing on in hot weather. You sweated. You had to take them off to wipe the bands, wipe your forehead. And people...
And they were less comfortable to wear than the forage cap.
Oh, they were hot, and you could feel it on your forehead. I can imagine little Larry Gaines, you know, the maniac and both of them with cheese cutter. He looked was funny, really.
Just on the subject of headgear, I mean, the DLI had this rule that they had to wear their fore and aft directly straight on their head.
Yeah.
When you were out at these dances, was that real relaxed if you were a private soldier?
What they did at the dances, they took the cap FS, as it was called, and put it on their epaulets and didn't wear it. But when they were with their girls as well, they put it on the baby's ankle as equal with everybody else. In fact, the other chaps of the army used to laugh at the DLI. I wish they do to this day.
While you're at Winchelsea, when you went on leave, there was a business of having the leave pass signed or something. Do you remember anything about that, how that would work? Or the enlisted men would have to have the leave pass signed? Or
they would have the pass given to them by the Sergeant Major. If they went on leave, they would have a pass which they'd have to carry as a means of identification to the Red Caps when they passed through the London terminal. The Red Caps in London were eyes like eagles. Whenever I was beyond London. I had to pass through London every time. I was never fortunate to be billeted anywhere near to Wales. I had to go through London terminal. And I had my pass inspected in all months for the and I still get the train from Wales, it comes in with Paddington, Kelsey Passways, and I show it. But when I was a signal sergeant, I was very proud to show it, because it had a red ink. Key personnel, priority, and I had to be opened up, because I was a signal. I would have been rushed through the lot, because I had a red ink. I was allowed through, I was a priority, if it were invaded.
Did you keep in touch with developments in the signals platoon after you'd left? I mean, did you have interest in what your successor was getting up to?
I quietly was most, because I loved signaling. It was my life. I was very sorry to lose it, you know. And thanks to Major Robinson, I hated leaving the signals because I loved signaling. And I kept in touch with them, especially Corporal Bennett and Tom Baker. And even new chaps who came to the signals from Glasgow, Corporal Billington was one. There's another Corporal Addison. They joined from Glasgow. I don't know very well. I kept in touch with them yesterday.
They would be based at Rye at this stage.
They were in Rye, that's right. And there's a chap Logan. Yes. And Gerling became the adjutant. He was promoted.
Now, at this stage in 1942, late 42, about what percentage of the NCOs do you estimate would be experts in Hartsman compared to DLI?
Quite a lot, looking at that, most of the senior NCOs now, they'd be promoted in the last corporals to become sergeants. In D Company alone, there was Thomas Broadhead, Mrs. Thomas Broadhead, Charlie Bray, Vic Walker, and possibly King.
So possibly all three platoon sergeants were experts in Hearts in your company?
Probably
all three of the platoon sergeants were experts in Hearts.
They were, yes, and there was a Sergeant Gregory at one time as well. Yes, but Gregory didn't stay, he went somewhere else because he could mess. Yes, but in D Company alone, the senior NCOs, therefore, would be five in D Company.
And that was all bits and hearts,
mate. Yeah.
What about the percentage of private soldiers? But what percentage of Northeasterners compared to the rest of the...
Not a large percentage of private soldiers. Not a large percentage. Very, very low percentage of private soldiers. Most of them, as Charlie Bay said to you, I think, had a chance to become or were given a snipe of leaving Bedford, but they were certain Charlie didn't want it.
So there were still private soldiers, bits
and
hearts,
mate.
So about what percentage of what would be Geordies, the nominee?
Very low percentage of private soldiers.
This is Beds and Hearts.
Beds and Hearts.
Yeah.
Very, very low percentage.
So at this time, the battalion, in terms of its lower ranks, ordinary or other ranks, would be predominantly Northeastern.
Absolutely. The new draft that came in civvies in Morton Hall, mainly, most of it was a draft in August 1940, and reinforced by a chap who came in from Bradsworth as the months and the couple of years went on. In that 2 years, I think from August 1940 to the film to 42, we went to November, Christmas 40, 42. You could say 2 years from 1940, August. Yeah, August 1940 to August 1942 is 2 years. We were reinforced by quite a lot from Bradsworth.
And that would be mainly...
To bring us up to battle strength. To bring us up to battle strength.
It's been mentioned that you had quite a few men from Birmingham as well for some reason. You had a lot of...
All over the place. Corporal Price from Birmingham, I didn't know that. Quite a few.
Before we move on to you have the move of the battalion from Winchelsea, have you any memories of, we've mentioned the anti-tank platoon and the anti-aircraft platoon. Obviously they'll have been based elsewhere from Winchelsea, but do you have any memories of those platoons during the exercises?
Not really. I remember that number two platoon was ACAC, but they didn't seem to have a regular leader for them.
What were they armed with, is that it? Just Bren guns?
Brens, and some of the cannons were placed, had Brens on them. Yes, that's right. The ACAC platoon at that time was Brens, Bren guns only.
And what about the anti-air, and what about the anti-tank platoon? What would it be?
Anti-tank was under Ryan. They were rifle boys, anti-tank, and later the field mortar.
And on the exercises, would you ever be involved with the carriers in terms of would you be doing exercises where you'd be trying to bring stores over rough country? I mean, would you always be in the truck or would you ever get out into the carriers?
We had a quota of 300 trucks and it was all compact.
We'll get on to that. Now, at this stage, during the exercises, in terms of the rations and so on, what kind of rations did you have? Had the combo rations come in yet?
The combo rations were for overseas only. We didn't see a combo ration until we went to North Africa.
So what were the provisions on exercises like Harold?
Fresh bread. We had ordinary UK rations, and the troops usually had their enormous big containers two or three containers to accompany, which would be more than adequate to sort of make a stew for the whole company. And one for porridge in the morning with the breakfast, another one for tea or cocoa, and the other for stew. And it is usually on exercises boosting.
Because of your job as a CQMS, you wouldn't have gone through the battle school, and you wouldn't have actually experienced that as such.
Not me, because the battle school came on later, and in a way I was sorry, because the army changed during my short time in the army, when it was quite normal to join a battalion and be a soldier in the battalion. We adapted ourselves, you know, to match the enemy. They asked for the good swimmers to be the commandos, and anybody who was a good swimmer went volunteered for the commandos and would be sent to Fort William to Scotland, and out of the battalion would give his cap badge that he would become a commander wearing the green beret. He'd probably be part of the Royal Marines first, because they were all the Roman commanders, and then the commander of the green berets. And then they asked for volunteers and paratroopers and so on. And so they were forming these new arms of the service from the Ordinary Infantry Battalion.
Can you remember specific examples of these notices going up and of anybody actually volunteering?
We lost, yes, we were asked this night. We lost quite a lot of people who, because they could swim and all that sort of thing, and they wanted to fly. We got people who joined the commandos, quite a large contingent of the commandos, and also the paratroopers.
Can you remember any names of men that...
I can see the faces, but I can't remember the names. But I know that we had some of the daredevils, as they call them, you know. We've always had the chap who didn't care about that, you know. And so he would go and join the commandos, and we admired them, really, because they had about adequate special training. Then, of course, the battle of the schools came, and most of the infantrymen, the ones who were in the platoons, went. But I was not that. I became a quartermaster sergeant very early in my career, and I wasn't even called upon as company sergeant major to sort of, you know.
So where was the battle school, do you think?
Oh, they went to various places. They went to army camps at Warminster and Arbourfield and God knows where they are. They had special schools and did drills. Most of these people went on these courses. And as well, the courses, you know, all over the place, especially in the Wiltshire area.
What about when the battalion would or the companies would go on firing exercises at the firing ranges? Would you support that with rations, or would that be like delegated down to?
Well, they'd be on the firing range very, very early. That's right, and they would be cooks, of course. You know, you'd be on the range for days, really. The bats, having to go through your getting yourself categorised and. Yes, the cooks, they'd be cooks.
Categorise, what do you mean by that?
Well, you'd get your points, the shooting, bullets, eyes, and things like that on the bus. And you've got chaps who would never shoot a slow bullseye in your back. And you get others who are very good at grouping, you know.
And you mentioned earlier that CSM Broadhead was...
He was in charge of the bus at Bedford. He trained all the beds in Hearts. He was a depot. He was a depot rifle range instructor, and he was very good indeed. We went to place in Northamptonshire, not very far from
this was in your Beds and Hearts days.
Beds and Hearts, yeah, right. Yeah. And we all passed out under George Broadhead when we were in the signals, when we were ordinary soldiers. He was in charge, he was the ITC BUTS range instructor.
Did anybody else in the company, in D Company, have like a reputation as being a really good shot, as being like a good marksman?
Well,
Or bad shots. I mean, did anybody have like a reputation as being a useless shot? I mean, any of the NCOs or anything?
Well, there were quite a lot of those as well. Long before they came to school, you and then the records would go to the sergeant major, George Portland, and then of course old George left the ITC and was in the swimming house and was on the list for Singapore, and then switched because I told you before, switched to Edinburgh.
While we're still at Winchelsea, the fact that the cinema at Rye was bombed features in quite a few veterans' memories. Do you have any memories of that?
I remember, of course, when I was at Rye, I knew that Winchelsea had been bombed. But some chaps took it upon themselves to sort of cancel it, check out from Winchelsea into Rye to go to the cinema. They were free, some of them, that we went on second cards. As I said, if they wanted to go to Winchelsea, a lot of them walked. And there were no passing cars to which, unless there was the odd army vehicle, you were very lucky, you know, if they were passing on the walk to Rye.
And would you be able to, on your daily ration run, you'd give a lift to whoever, or would you?
If anybody, if you saw somebody who was halfway there, we'd say stop the crap and jump on. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, we'd help out like that. Or if somebody would give us the old thumb, you know, we'd sort of relent.
Any other memories of Winchelsea before we move on for this stage of your career? Anything else?
Well, the only memories about Winchelsea is that there was an old boy there. He was very, very old indeed. And he was paid, he was employed with a telescope to stand on a big stone at this vantage point. Going up the hill into Winchelsea, one had to go through a big stone archway, which was one of the gateways to the town, because of the French ladies were not. And when you go through this big stone archway, you'd see a wall vantage point with a big jutting sort of style stepping stone there, looking out to sea. And this old boy was still, he was about 80, and in the war, he was still being paid by the Sun Ports for keeping a lookout with a telescope looking for the French, scanning the seas for the enemy. And he was still there at this point. Of course, he was there. By now, he was redundant in the war, but we used to see him, he used to tell us.
What was it?
He was a lookout. I remember that particularly.
So, by this stage, mid-42, late-42, was the rumour mill starting to turn in terms of like what you... Because you were like a fully trained battalion by now.
We were a fully trained battalion. We had done that time. A full 2 years training to August 1942. That's exactly 2 years to the day. August 1942 was 2 years, as far as I was concerned, and then more than that, because I was experts in France. But the battalion was deemed to be ready for operational duties. We were up to scratch with all the equipment and carriers and the vehicles had been, the lorries had been doctored with the exhausts coming up, the side of the lorries that we could
take
in water, you know. Oh yes, we knew that it was going to be, we knew we were fully operational, and the lorry, I think the transport was one of the last things we brought up in scratch for numbers.
So for before that you weren't quite up to strength in transport then?
Probably we were not fully. We had Canadian or American Chevrolet trucks, special shipment.
And what were they like?
I think they were Canadian Chevrolets, and they weren't British trucks. They were really lovely, easy to drive, super trucks, and they were sheds, all of them.
So You're at Winchelsea and you get orders to move. I mean, can you just talk us through that? When that when was that, and how did it manifest itself?
When you're at Winchelsea, first of all, in 1942, we were very, very interested to learn that there'd been a raid at Dieppe and the Lord Lovett, I think, and the commanders, and we were at Winchelsea then. And we didn't see anything in that, of course, but we knew that Dieppe happened when we were at Winchelsea. There was one of the things I remember particularly about Winchelsea, which I never thought that I was on it, and none of us were at Dieppe. But I remember that was what happened. That was the Canadians, of course. They were at the end as well. And that was why we were in Sussex. Now it's coming to mind, you know, they were there because it was convenient as well, on the south coast for the Dieppe raid, which was a failure, but they learned a lot from it. That was Dieppe. Then later in the year, we were aware of the invasion of Tunisia. That was in November. Oh, headlines everywhere. And we knew that was where the possibility was. And then we were going to go because no one was going to go anywhere else, not even on the UK army. He had left the Tunisian and taken the UK army at Alain. And shortly after he joined the UK army at Alain, the Hanover Regency, in the autumn. Then the news broke that they had invaded an operation called Algiers, Oran and Algiers. We knew then that they were advancing very, very rapidly among Tunis, but of course then they'd rained like really over weeks, and there was a stalemate in North Africa, and at that time, November time, we got much more orders. Where were we going to go? Nobody knew. It was a secret.
Where were the, how were the marching orders?
Where that's were right. The news came in November. We were going to have embarkation leave. We were going to move to Camberley. And we were going to move to Camberley prior to a move to Liverpool.
And you knew this?
We knew. Mm-hmm. So we all had this leave. We were allowed to tell our loved ones that it was embarkation leave. And it was known as embarkation leave. And it was about November, and we moved to Camberley during the end of November, early December.
And did you have your leave before you went to Camberley, or after you moved to Camberley?
I had my leave from Winchelsea, mm-hmm. and I came back, and then we moved to Camberley, and in Camberley it was all work for me. Leading up to Christmas time, when we actually sailed on Christmas Day, so we must have been the week before Christmas, shall we say, December 20, from December 15 to December 20, we were really in Camberley, packing, getting things ready for the move, Icon Royal, and train.
Just move a little bit back from that. Your move from Winchelsea to Camberley, have you got any memories of that, how that was organised? Because that would have been a movement of a battalion. That's quite a lot of men, a lot of equipment to
absolutely
be moved.
Absolutely, but quite. I rather think that those who could go by transport, the MT took all their vehicles and carried stores to Winchelsea by road. But I rather think that the battalion, I'm not sure, I think that the battalion had a quick move by train, I think, to Camberley. But it's a funny thing, you can't quite remember these little things, but I think it was a quick move by train, but it wasn't very far.
And did you have a lot of paperwork at Winchelsea before you moved?
Oh, yeah, we had to destroy quite a lot of stuff, and we had to sort of get everything, all the returns sent in, particularly. We were issued with new items which you'd never seen before, namely small Tommy cookers, which every man was given one. and I had to learn about it.
And what's a Tommy Cook, and how does it work?
Tommy Cook has those small things, about twice as big as the palm of your hand. And they've got bits of metal which you crisscrossed, and you put a small chemical thing on it, and lit it with a match. And it was like methane spirits thing, you know. And you put your mess on top of that. And each man had one, so that he could cook himself a hot dinner. And he could use this mess to make it get some steam. A hot meal on a dolly cooker. And each man was given one of those, and it's my job to demonstrate the Tommy cooker, issue to them duly, and the use of it. I give a little lecture on it.
And when did you do that?
Yes.
When?
I'm doing that in Winchelsea. And also, we had another little session on the boat, talking about it mainly.
Was it an efficient enough device? Did it work?
Oh, yes. Yes, very well, a novelty. They were damn good. They were called Tommy Cookers. And every man had this small thing, which you did bits. And you got two bits of metal, crisscross it like that, and you had your base. And there's a little round thing that you put your little sort of candle thing, your chemical tablet.
And what would you heat up on it? What would that be? Any of your tinned rations could be heated up on it.
That's right. You could open a tin of McConaughey's or a tin of beans or whatever, if you were cut off, and you could have yourself a hot meal, make some soup.
What are the new items of equipment?
Even makes some tea. You were given a sort of a flat tin of tea sugar and powder, and you could put some water in your mess tin on your Tommy cooker, a spoonful of tea sugar and powder, and it makes a mess tin full of tea.
So what are the other new items of equipment? You've mentioned the Tommy Cooker. What else that was new that you hadn't seen before at this stage?
That was the thing that was novelty. Most of it was a Tommy Cooker. I don't think there was anything else that was new, really, but everybody had to be checked up to strength.
Did you have a certain establishment of stores that you had to have before you
went? Everything had to be according to the War Office Ministry of Defence scale, and everything that you can think of, from your compasses to your knives to your clasp knives and your whistles and your even watches were issued to sergeants. Expensive, luminous watches, and then signed for them, they're going to be able to use them as well.
What about binoculars today?
Binoculars, yes, binoculars.
What ranks?
Revolvers.
What rank would qualify for binoculars?
Platoon sergeant. Yes, you have binoculars and can really use them. And compasses, expensive liquid compasses.
What about you? You mentioned you had to destroy a lot of stuff before you moved. What did you have to destroy?
Stuff that we didn't need, paperwork and the return stamp, all finished. You know, there were boxes and boxes of rubbish and records and property which we didn't want to carry.
Records of what kind?
All sorts of returns, there had been return copies. Strengths of this and that. You can imagine, I mean, a devil of a lot of paperwork. You know, paperwork was used in the army, and you kept records of everything.
But you managed to.
It was like red tape finished, thank God. And that was when you're in battle, you were relieved of a lot of records. You didn't have any of this time consuming. Time wasting returns and writing, and I loved it. To get rid of all that, as a doer, I'd rather do something, I'd rather dig it down than do returns.